This is the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, episode 79. Welcome to the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, where we teach wealth building hacks for lawyers, engineers, and MBAs. I'm your host, Andrew Chen. All right, thanks so much again for tuning into the podcast. For today's episode, I invited another guest to come and share their tips and strategies and insights with us. So before we jump into that, as always, I want to invite you to join the private Hack Your Wealth Facebook group. You can access that at hackyourwealth.com/FB. Definitely encourage you to join us there. It is a place for us to connect, have a two-way dialogue. I'm in there every single day, often multiple times a day, and I try to respond to every question and comment there. And it's a place where people can ask about financial independence, early retirement, tax strategies, real estate investing, side business income, online income, career transitions, career advice, or just ask about whatever's on their mind related to personal finance or career-related issues. Definitely encourage you to check that out. It's a great, friendly, helpful group of people, and we would love to have you there. Again, hackyourwealth.com/FB. All right, let's jump in to today's interview. My guest today is Anne Garcia. Anne is a Portland-based certified financial planner who specializes in advising on college financial planning and financial aid. She advises parents on how to navigate college financial aid, and she writes frequently on this topic on her blog, thecollegefinanciallady.com. There's a good amount that's changed over the last year about financial aid, so I invited Anne back to the podcast today to share with us the latest updates and tips when it comes to applying for college financial aid. Anne, thanks so much for joining us. The topic is timely since families are getting ready for back to school now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's great to be back.
So you've been a guest on the podcast a couple times now, episodes 26 and 53, which were about 529 plans and college financial aid strategy. But for those who may not have caught those episodes or who maybe just aren't as familiar with your background, could you help orient us? Like, what is your background when it comes to college financial planning and financial aid? Like, how did you get into becoming an expert on this?
Yeah, so I'm a fee-only financial advisor. And as I was getting started in my career, I noticed that a lot of our clients were asking questions about college, and very few advisors were prepared to answer them. And at the same time, I was a parent of twins who were late elementary school at that point. And I thought, you know, this is something I need to know about for myself anyway. And so I just kind of started digging into the topic and found that I was getting the same questions again and again and again. And I thought, well, I could just write these all on a blog. And so I started doing that as a self-improvement project about 8 years ago. And apparently I haven't improved enough to stop.
So. I love it. Okay. Could you maybe walk us through the high level college financial aid application process, including like the key dates that parents and students should pay attention to when they're applying this year?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of people think of the FAFSA when they think of the financial aid process. So let's just start there. You will complete your first FAFSA in the fall of your student's senior year of high school, and you'll renew it every year throughout their college career. The FAFSA is available every year on October 1st, and you can certainly complete it right away, but actual deadlines are set by the schools, and they tend to be much later than that. As a general rule, though, if you submit your FAFSA by the time you submit your application, you'll get your financial aid award when you get your acceptance. Another general rule is it's usually best to complete it sooner rather than later because there is a pool of financial aid that's available and awarded on a first come, first serve basis. Mm-hmm. There are a few other key dates in the aid process, though, not just that October 1st, you can do it. The FAFSA, for example, so the calculation for the FAFSA is based on your income and your assets, both the parents and the students. The FAFSA uses your income from your most recently completed tax return. And so that means that if you're completing the FAFSA in the fall of 2021, it's going to use your 2020 income. So if you're a parent of a high school senior this fall, that means the FAFSA is using the income year that started January 1st of your student's sophomore year of high school. If you're not the parent of a high school senior, but maybe of a junior or a sophomore or someone like that, keep in mind that you are now in the year or coming up on the year that's going to be the most consequential income year for the FAFSA, and income, again, is the biggest component of your expected family contribution. So the other key date for the FAFSA is the date you file, because the other piece of the formula is your assets, and your assets are reported on the day that you file. Your assets being the money in your bank account, all of your 529 accounts, any taxable investment accounts you have, things like that. So it's always a good idea when you're thinking about when you're going to do the FAFSA to think about when your mortgage or your rent payment is due, when your credit card bill is due, you know, anything like that, and get those big bills out of the way. Likewise, if you have any large purchases planned that are going to soak up a bunch of your assets, you know, anything from a computer to a new car, just make sure that you actually spend that money and not just put it on your credit card, but pay the bill for them before you file the FAFSA, because a few thousand dollars here or there can make a bit of a difference. All of this points out that if you want to position yourself as best as possible for the FAFSA, don't wait till October 1st to start thinking about it. You know, planning needs to happen well in advance of filing it. If you wait until fall of senior year to think about it, you've lost most of the planning opportunities, because the income is the biggest piece of it. Talking about financial aid timelines, I mean, we tend to think of the FAFSA, but there are some other opportunities that exist while your student's in college. For example, and we tend to forget about this on the West Coast, but most families nationwide are eligible for the American Opportunity Tax Credit, which is a tax credit worth $2,500 per year per student. So to be eligible for that, your adjusted gross income needs to be below the phase-out range, which is from $160,000 to $180,000 of adjusted gross income for married couples. So if you're anywhere in that threshold range, you'll want to plan for things like 401k and IRA contributions during that year, because those will help to reduce your adjusted gross income and get you the tax credit. I'm a big believer in free money. So another date that I like to remind people of is December 31st, because if you're in one of the majority of states that give tax benefits for 529 contributions, typically those are required to be done by December 31st, and not just made, but received by the plan on December 31st. There may be a few states left that still let you contribute up to the tax deadline, but by and large, December 31st is the cutoff date. So, you know, getting back to that timeline, basically FAFSA available in the fall, fill it out on the best possible early date, and then you will get your aid award when you get your acceptance in, depending on when the colleges involved do it, between December and April.
Okay, got it. Really helpful kind of framework overview. You had mentioned that income, since income is the largest determinant of your ultimate award, and you were encouraging families to think early, not think, you know, kind of the fall of senior year. What are the sort of key planning opportunities that might be available make your income put your income in the best light possible? Maybe if you could talk about maybe the more restrictive case where the person is a W-2 wage earner, and then obviously the more flexible case where perhaps you're self-employed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the most important thing to remember, and I think this is confusing for a lot of families, is that the FAFSA uses your total income, not your adjusted gross income. So a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to load up my 401k in my FAFSA year because that brings my adjusted gross income down. In fact, you do have to add back all of your pre-tax or your untaxed income in the formula. When the FAFSA looks at income, it's looking at your total income. So basically your gross salary, and you know, any passive income, any business income, any investment income, all of that gets added in. There are a couple of big subtractions that the FAFSA makes in the formula. One is what's called an income protection allowance. And that is currently a number that's roughly equivalent to the federal poverty level for a family of your size, right? It's enough income for you to survive. Theoretically, I think if you ask most families of four how they might survive on $28,000 a year, they would struggle to answer that question. But that's a philosophical thought for another time. The other thing that is subtracted from your income is your actual tax liability. So not your taxes paid, but your federal income tax liability. And so thinking of that from a planning perspective, you know, one planning opportunity that most families have is to pay more or less taxes in any given year. And so oftentimes people say, well, I'm going to load up my 401k, bring down my adjusted gross income. And in fact, that has the opposite effect on your income for the FAFSA because it reduces your tax bill and you actually get to subtract your taxes from your income. You know, families, so getting back to your original point, there are different planning strategies depending on your tax status. Families who are really just W-2 earners, your main planning opportunity revolves around paying more taxes in your FAFSA years. And so that might be changing some of your 401k contributions to Roth. It may be, you know, if you itemize on your taxes, it may be the year before your FAFSA year, making your January mortgage payment in December so that you don't have that interest, that mortgage interest deduction. You know, again, if you're itemizing, pulling your charitable contributions into non-FAFSA years. Mm-hmm. So that's really your main planning opportunity as a W-2 worker. I think if you went to your, if you went to your boss and said, hey, can I get my January paycheck in December, they would probably say no. If you typically get a bonus in January and ask for that in December, that's also probably not going to work. So just not a lot of planning opportunities for W-2 earners. It really is just around your tax liability. If you're a business owner, it's very different. You know, there are lots of things that businesses can do. You know, typically, I know as a business owner myself, I get recommendations from my CPA every December to bring in all my business expenses for the year and, do my first quarter, office supply shopping in December and things like that. If it's December before your first FAFSA income year and you're a business owner, you might choose not to do that. You might choose to defer those into your FAFSA year so you can have those expenses deducted against your income for the FAFSA. If you have employees, there are lots of things you can do, between profit sharing contributions in your 401k, bonuses, other incentives that happen in those FAFSA years. The other thing for self-employed people is how you structure your self-employed retirement plan. You know, if you're an LLC or an S corp, you can, you can have an individual 401k and have, max out your employer contributions to that because those don't actually, those are a business expense, not, not part of your personal income, as long as it's a plan that's not reported under that self-employed, line in the FAFSA. So definitely business owners have a whole lot more, flexibility on, in that regard. But yeah, it's become tougher and tougher to manage things for the FAFSA between changes to the FAFSA and changes to tax law with, less people itemizing and.
Got it. Okay. Good tips though. All right. So I wanted to shift a little bit to talking about some of the changes this year to the financial aid process since we last spoke. That parents should know about. What are some of the key things that have changed about the financial aid application process and about how the reward calculations are done that parents may want to know about going forward?
Yeah. So as part of last year's, the big omnibus spending bill that was passed at the end of 2020, there was a 170 plus page section called FAFSA simplification. And how you simplify things in 170 pages is It's good for insomniacs, let's say. So the simplification was supposed to go into effect with the FAFSA that comes out in the fall of 2022, so next year. But there are some changes that are being phased in over time. And then just in June, it was the Department of Education announced that they're actually pushing it back to the FAFSA that comes out in fall, pushing most of the changes back to the FAFSA that comes out in fall of 2023, which will be for the 2024-2025 school year. Apparently their technology couldn't handle this this magnitude of change in that short of a time. So there's a few key areas of change, and those are primarily going to impact three groups: families with multiple college students, grandparents who want to help out with college, and then divorced parents. In addition, they've reduced a bunch of the questions. So it's supposed to go down to about 31 questions. They haven't said which 31 are going to be there, although they've mentioned a couple that are coming out. I'm going to talk in great detail about all of these, but I want to preface this with one comment. This only pertains to the FAFSA and the federal needs analysis methodology. This does not pertain to the CSS profile, or at least the CSS profile has not come out and said that they're implementing any of these changes. And a lot of them are not pertinent to the profiles formula. Mm-hmm. So, and then the other thing is the really important thing to remember with the FAFSA is, yes, you should absolutely understand how the FAFSA works, understand how to get a low expected family contribution, understand all the inputs in it. But really, the most important thing about your FAFSA is what the schools you're applying to do with your FAFSA, because they're not under any obligation to meet your need. And so a lot of families spend so much time planning for the FAFSA and never research whether the schools they're applying to meet need. So I will step off of my soapbox and turn back to the topic at hand. So what are the changes that are coming to the FAFSA? The big one that's gotten a lot of attention is how the FAFSA treats families with multiple children. So the current formula, which will be in place for the 2021 FAFSA and the 2022 FAFSA, but not the 2023 FAFSA. The current formula divides your expected family contribution, or the EFC, which is basically the amount that the formula says that a family can afford to contribute to college costs annually, by the number of college students in the family. It's sort of like saying, okay, we know you've got all of this money and you're using some savings and some income to pay for college. And obviously each dollar can only get spent once. So we're going to divide it in half for you. There are some adjustments that they make. So it's not exactly 50% of what it would be for a single child, but
that's in the case of two kids.
Exactly. Yeah, in the case of two kids. So this is a great setup for someone like me, who's a parent of twins. because my expected family contribution is just that, it's the total amount that it's expected that my family, can shell out for college in any given year. However, the new formula is not going to divide by the number of students in college, and instead says that a family can pay that much money for each, college student. If you think about it, it doesn't really make a lot of sense when you've got a family with two or three college students and they're required to report all of their children's 529 accounts on all of their FAFSAs. You know, obviously each dollar in those accounts can only be spent one time, not three times. Mm-hmm. Another way of looking at it is this, which is that the current formula penalizes families for having children further apart. So why should I get a bigger benefit in financial aid than another family with two kids whose kids happen to have been four years instead of 4 minutes apart? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can debate the logistics of that. I feel like there should be adjustments to the formula, you know, on that basis, as well, but that is going to be a significant change for a lot of families. Next is, families who have grandparents who want to contribute to college. 529s are a great planning tool for grandparents. They're a great way for grandparents to help support their families. They're good for estate planning reasons and whatnot. The bad news historically has been that when you start spending money out of that grandparent 529, the student has to report it back as income. Mm-hmm. There's a question on the FAFSA currently that is called money paid on your behalf. And it says, did anyone pay money on your behalf? And that includes distributions from a 529 that's owned by anyone who isn't a parent on your FAFSA. So that can have a big impact on a student's financial aid. That question is going away. So it basically makes the grandparent 529 a freebie on the FAFSA. Another big change is coming for divorced parents. So under the current formula, the custodial parent for the FAFSA is the parent with whom the student spends the most time. The new formula requires it to be the parent who provides the most financial support for the student. This can be a really big change for a lot of families. You know, for divorced, at least nominally amicable parents, there can be a really big planning opportunity when there are significant income differences between, between the two ex-parents. That's going away, and now the higher earning parent is going to be, or not necessarily the higher earning, but the one who's providing the most support. So this can be a really gray area. For example, when you have two parents who both work and there isn't child support being paid by either one, mm-hmm. Less gray when you have, one parent's a very high earner and the other's a stay-at-home parent getting alimony, child support, and whatnot. It's pretty obvious where the financial support is coming from in that case. There have been some changes to the formula, such as increasing the income protection allowance. That's that amount that the family is allowed to subtract from income available to pay for college, and that'll be beneficial to larger families. Because it's the maximum amount is going from about $38,000 to almost $60,000. So that'll help larger families. I think across the board it's going up, 40 or 50%. Another big change is it's more interesting than impactful. The number that the FAFSA calculates is being renamed. So currently it's called the Expected Family Contribution, or EFC, which is sort of logical, but it's really a terrible name, because if you're a normal person who hears the phrase expected family contribution, you would think, oh, that's what I'm expected to pay for college. Now that I know what my expected family contribution is, I know what I should expect to pay for college, and that's how much college should cost. However, in the time since the FAFSA has been available, we've evolved to this world where schools aren't required to meet need, and many of them don't do that. In fact, very few meet full financial needs. So it's a bit of a rude awakening for families to hear that your expected family contribution is not what you should expect. I mean, I tell families to think of it as the minimum family contribution. So that's being renamed the Student Aid Index, or SAI. And really that speaks more to how most colleges and universities use the FAFSA, which is just that it's a tool to evaluate all students' ability to pay for college on a consistent set of metrics. So, taking all these changes into account, some people are jumping for joy, people whose grandparents have set aside the full cost of college. Others are really concerned, parents of multiple children, parents who have multiple college students who are likely to lose out on some need-based aid. And here's where, and of course, anyone who thought their expected family contribution was what they should expect to pay. But here's where it's really important to understand what the FAFSA does. The FAFSA is not the tooth fairy. It doesn't promise you anything other than access to federal financial aid dollars and student loans. It's a tool, as I said, that colleges use to evaluate all students' financial means on a consistent set of metrics. It does allocate things like Pell Grants, work study, subsidized loans that are all part of the federal financial aid toolkit. It, you know, and it gives access to the non-need-based financial federal programs like direct student loans that are unsubsidized, Parent PLUS loans, you know, grad school loans and whatnot. But beyond that, colleges can do whatever they want with your FAFSA data. There are some that say we meet full need. There are some that say we don't meet full need. There are some that say we meet full need through loans. And then, of course, there's the other financial aid form, the CSS profile, which is required by about 400 private schools. And, you know, when we talked about all these changes being really big, they're almost completely moot within within the profile. So the profile, for example, requires both parents in the event of a divorce to complete the profile. And so not just the custodial parent. The profile requires you to report all the 529s for which your student is a beneficiary, regardless of whether you own them or not. And then the profile's formula is far more opaque than the FAFSA. I mean, the FAFSA publishes their formula, how they calculate EFC. You know, you can just Google EFC formula guide and you will get the Department of Education's 30-page detailed worksheet of how to calculate your expected family contribution. There is no such thing for the profile.
It's fair to say if you're looking at mostly profile schools, then they're just like maybe you submit your FAFSA, but they actually don't really do anything with it. They just use their own profile info.
Pretty much. You know, you'll still need to submit a FAFSA because the majority of schools use the federal aid programs as part of their financial aid funding. So, you know, at a profile school where you're getting need-based aid, you might get institutional grants from the school, but you might also get work study, a subsidized loan, Parent PLUS loans, a Pell grant. You know, any of those things can be part of the package, and those require you to complete the FAFSA. The other thing about the profile is schools can add their own questions. So when we filled out the profile, one of the schools my daughter applied to wanted to know what cars we drove. And another one actually asked how much we had spent on her summer job. You know, given that there's a whole bunch of internships, air quote internships or air quote summer jobs that that are really summer camps, mm-hmm. you know, that basically you're paying to have this job. So things like that. The other thing is even FAFSA schools that are private schools can ask their own set of questions. And I thought it was really interesting for my daughter's school this year. My daughter attends a private university that's a FAFSA only school, and they have some supplemental questions that you always have to answer as part of their aid process. And this year, one of the questions was how many other college students are in your household? So take this all, you know, take all the changes with a grain of salt. Colleges do know that changes to the federal needs analysis methodology do not translate to families having more money available. Mm-hmm. And some of them will address that, some won't. You know, the profile continues to ask how many college students you have in the household. So there will be pros and cons. And many of the negative changes for families who are higher need will be offset by the increase in things like the income protection allowance.
Right. Got it. Interesting. Okay. So if we're thinking about, you know, let's set aside the profile schools for a moment because they essentially have an alternate methodology. But for the ones that really do rely on the FAFSA, given the changes that you mentioned, the multiple children, the divorced parents scenario and the grandparents 529 or grandparents contribution scenario. I'm just wondering, well, particularly for the grandparent 529 scenario where the form no longer asks like if you're getting any income from outside part or non-direct family, non-parental sources, I guess. Doesn't that present like a huge planning opportunity? Like why, I mean, sorry for the simpleton question, why wouldn't I as a parent just gift my parents, i.e. my child's grandparents, the free federal exempt amount gift every year for a couple of years? They will load up a 529 and then that gets paid down when my kid goes to college and not reported as income. Maybe that's too dumb. I'm curious, like, you know, doesn't that open up a lot of planning opportunities?
Well, you know, the other great planning opportunity that opens up, because that is a strategy that we are encouraging a lot of our families who have good intergenerational relationships to pursue. You know, the other great thing is, as a parent who owns the 529s, you report all of your kids' 529s. If the grandparents have the 529, you know, and sometimes what we have people do is the parents open the 529 for the oldest child, and then the grandparents have it for the, you know, for the subsequent children. When it comes to the profile, you know, so first and foremost on the FAFSA, you're only reporting the one 529. Then when it comes to the profile, because you know, because the profile asks about all of the 529s for that particular student, you don't have to report all the sibling 529s if you do it that way. So it can definitely help on the asset side. Something to remember: assets are a very small part of the formula. So 47 cents of every incremental dollar of income you have is considered available to pay for college. 5 cents of every dollar of assets you have is considered available to pay for college. So these are good strategies to pursue, for example, in a family that is lower income but higher savings, mm-hmm. Where that's, you know, where the assets are going to be a larger part of the picture for them. And another thing that we see a lot of is families who receive an inheritance right around when their kids are in college, because that's just sort of a normal, you know, life timeline. And then you're trying to figure out what to do with all this extra money that you suddenly have that is going to destroy, you know, years of college planning.
How do you handle that? I would think like make it go into a trust that doesn't pay out until the kids are out of college or something like that.
Yeah, you still have to report all your trusts, but you know, to your point about, you know, gifting or to a 520 to the other grandparents to have a 529, or you know, if you have a sibling whose kids aren't yet college age, where you can, you know, where they can hold your 529 for you. Here's the challenge with all of these strategies: you know, you're really reliant on that other person following through, mm-hmm. and not, say, changing the beneficiary on that account.
Right. Or it's family, you know. I know that can go both ways, but
it's definitely a gamble. You know, a big planning opportunity for you know, for divorced parents, where it's a little bit less clear about, because particularly, you know, when students get into the, you know, get older and into the college years, there's typically less child support, mm-hmm. less alimony being, you know, being paid back and forth between the parents. So when there's a wealthier, you know, when one parent is wealthier and wants to provide more for college, having that 529 set up can be very beneficial, because if the child is just taking, not the child, well, the student, if the student is just taking money out of a 529, that doesn't actually, you know, the IRS considers a 529 a completed gift to the beneficiary. And so when a parent has funded a 529 and the student is withdrawing money from that 529, for FAFSA purposes, one might say that is not providing current financial support. That's that's a gift that they gave to the student in the past.
Oh, interesting. Will that be successful? Or is that like,
hasn't gone into effect yet.
Okay.
But I think you could absolutely, you know, you could absolutely make the argument on the basis that the IRS says this is a completed gift. This isn't the parent providing support. It is the student using something that they already have.
Interesting. Are there any planning opportunities for divorced parents in this kind of this new regime? I know it's not taking effect for a couple of years, but now that, you know, it used to be that if you're divorced, put the child with, like, even if it's only nominally with the lower earning parent. Are there any alternate planning opportunities that arise now with this upcoming rule change?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it just depends on the relationship between, you know, between the two exes and how much they're willing to work together and how much flexibility each of them has. Because if one parent is receiving child support, it would be very difficult to make the case that the other parent isn't the one providing the most financial support. Mm-hmm. Right? Because even if mom and dad each run their own household, pay for the kids' groceries while they're there, and, you know, equally contribute to all of their activities costs and shared the cost of their car and have joint custody, but the lower earning parent gets 183 days of the year. if there is financial support flowing in one direction, that is basically saying who's providing the most financial support. So then the question becomes, you know, are you willing to give up that financial support in exchange for potentially doing better on the FAFSA? Mm-hmm.
And just to be clear, it means that the analysis for determining the EFC is entirely then analyzed based on the higher earning parents profile, right?
Correct. So not the lower earning parent. So then of course you could say, well, you know, give all the 529s to the lower earning parent, but again, income is so much bigger of a factor than assets in that case. The other thing is the current FAFSA wants to know where the student spent the most time in the year leading up to doing the FAFSA. In the new FAFSA, it will be based on the income year that's being used for the FAFSA. So that's a sophomore year of high school question, as opposed to senior year of high school question. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's quite possible that with a fully dependent child, there's a whole lot less flexibility about things like child support and whatnot. I have no idea how the FAFSA will keep track of all these things. I would not say that this is a source of heavy auditing. I've never heard of, you know, a school requesting, you know, a sleep log from a parent to confirm that, that in fact the student was with them 183 days. So I don't know how they might suss out whether or not there is money going back and forth between the parents, you know, other than that you do, you know, if the custodial parent reports that untaxed child support, or if they're receiving untaxed alimony, depending on when their divorce was, you know, they do have to add that into the formula. So absent transactions like that, I'm not sure how that all gets found.
Got it. Okay. Any
which
other...
is not to be considered with me saying you should go ahead and cheat on this, but
right. Sure. Any other major sort of changes to call out that are upcoming? I didn't realize they were actually getting pushed out that far. So it sounds like, you know, if you have a kid that's about to go into college, you're not going to hit this anyway until maybe they're a sophomore or junior. And if you already have a kid that's in college, they might be graduated by the time this stuff comes into effect. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's far less pertinent for students who are currently in college, especially if they are the youngest in their family, because the change that's going to have the biggest impact for a lot of families is the multiple children piece. And so, if you are the youngest of three children and you're currently a college student, you could reasonably expect that by your senior year, you're the only college student in your household anyway. Where, if you look at the timeline, so 2022, and so the original plan was all this would go into effect in the FAFSA that you fill out in 2022 for the 2023, 2024 school year. Now they're saying they're phasing it out back by 1 year. They have announced several minor changes that are going to go into effect in the current FAFSA. Those are things like removing the penalties for having a previous drug conviction and not requiring, not, well, they'll still have questions about previous drug convictions and selective service registration, but the responses to those will not be shared, will not be used by the system. So then it's a question of what goes into effect in 2022 and what goes into effect in 2023. And that is very unclear at this point. I do think if you are a family who's just at the start of this aid process, or who will have kids in school during these changing years, an important thing to do right now, if you're impacted by this, is reach out to your school's financial aid office and ask them to confirm that they will keep your aid package as is, based on the current methodology for all 4 years of your student's education. Because what you don't want to do is say yes to a school where you've been given a generous aid package only to find out that 2 years into your education, you're going to lose your financial aid because of changes in the formula. So that would be my number one piece of advice is ask your school to confirm that your aid will continue under the current rules. I think too, if you are just getting
Sorry, but
started,
don't colleges, they only grant year by year. Is that not
they
correct?
only grant year by year. However, if it's their own funds, so typically if you're getting a very generous scholarship, it's coming from the school itself. And they have a great deal of discretion in how they disperse those funds. So, if you're the federal aid pieces that you can get are the Pell Grant, the FSEOG grant, work study, and an unsubsidized loan. You could lose any of those in your package on the basis of the changes to the formula if you're eligible for any of those. But like I said, I believe that the increase in the income protection allowance is going to offset the loss of the second, the loss of the multiple child discount in the lower income levels. But the people who are really going to be impacted by this are middle income families of multiple children, where your EFC might go from 18,000 to 36,000, which will
What income level does that break point, or does it really start to transition based on the two changes, interacting with each other?
So I would say probably people below about 120,000 of income will come out fairly similar in the formula once you get above that, because that puts you about 120,000 is going to give you an expected family contribution that's roughly equivalent to the cost of in-state public college.
I see. So that
Varies
is to say,
from state to state, but
if your family makes basically more than 120K, then the more kids there are in the family that are co in college at the same time, the worse you are off under this new regime. But if you're under 120K, the income increase that's allowed as an like an exemption from your from consideration in calculating your EFC essentially will offset multiple kids that you may have. Is that basically the right way to think about it? Okay. Got it.
And so But getting back to the point about families who are just starting this process or who will have students in college under both formulas, which is, current senior, here's high school seniors and juniors, again, depending on the timeline of the implementation, you do want to make so upfront things you can do are do the FAFSA forecaster. And the URL for that is FAFSA4caster. Hmm. Not the URL, but just Google that and you will get it. Do that. It only shows the current formula, so you have to do it twice. Once with the number of actual students you have in college currently, and once with just a single student, and you'll get an approximately equivalent. Again, there are other adjustments to the formula, so it won't be quite that big of a number, but you'll get a sense for where you're going to fall as far as expected family contribution or student aid index. The other thing to do is, as your student becomes interested in colleges, do the net price calculator for those schools. And again, do it with one student and do it with the number of students you might have. That way you can at least get a sense of how much of my financial aid is driven by having multiple overlapping students. That's something that families with multiple children in college should do anyway, because unless you're a twin parent, you're going to have some years with one student, some with two, maybe even some with three. And you want to make sure that you're not making assumptions about what your aid package is going to look like that turn out to not be true after the older sibling graduates anyway. So, and make that part of your research, such that if you are accepted to a school with a financial aid package that is based on siblings, you can go back to that school and ask them to confirm that they will consider siblings in their needs analysis methodology for all 4 years of your students, student's education.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Are there any other major or noteworthy changes upcoming that parents should know about?
So one of the other big things is I think the changes to the FAFSA are going to be really beneficial for lower income families. So a couple of things are happening. One is the simplified formula, which is currently for families with incomes up to $50,000. That income threshold is going up to $60,000. And the way it stands currently, so after the 2018 tax law changes went into effect, they had to come up with a new way of figuring out who qualified for this. Because it used to be, if you were eligible to file a 1040A or 1040EZ, then you were eligible and your income was below $50,000, then you were eligible for the simplified formula, which didn't require you to report assets. Once 1040A and 1040EZ went away after the 2018 tax law changes, they came up with a new set of tests, and it was basically there was a list of tax forms that if you filed them, you weren't eligible. And basically it ruled out anyone who was receiving alimony, who contributed to an HSA account. It was just a bunch of weird little loopholes. People who collected Social Security, all of them are not eligible for the simplified formula. And so the income level is going up for the simplified formula, and they're actually increasing the group of people who are eligible for the formula. And that's just,
doing away with that checklist of things, for example.
It's just a shorter checklist of things for it.
Where can parents find the checklist?
Good question. So a lot of the details of this have not yet been published. The main place that you can find them is by looking up the simplified formula language in the omnibus bill. And it is, I kid you not, 170 pages. So I keep telling myself I'm going to sort through it and list all that up there, but I haven't done it yet. Who knows? By the time this podcast is live, maybe it'll be on my site. The other thing is that eligibility for Pell Grants is expanding, and that'll be a really positive change. Part of it is just increasing the income protection allowance, but now you can also have a negative EFC. Well, once the changes come to place, you can have a negative EFC. There are families whose incomes are so low that once all the elements are subtracted, like the income protection allowance and whatnot, their EFC or their SAI is actually negative. And so, so that also allows colleges to grant more aid, because colleges are restricted to, who participate in the federal funds programs are restricted to, only providing enough aid to meet the difference between, demonstrated need and cost of attendance. And so for someone whose need would be calculated to be a negative number, they actually lose out on aid dollars. The other big change is it's the formula will be much more favorable to independent students. So independent students really, if they don't have a family of their own, are treated very poorly in the formula. And there are lots of students who are legitimately independent, young adults who would like to go back to college. And their income and assets in the current formula get treated the same way as a dependent student's, where all of their assets are considered available and assessed at a very high rate, and their income protection allowance is, less than $7,000. So the new formula does improve things for independent students. So, young adults thinking of going back to college will hopefully have more opportunities to do so.
Got it. By the way, when does the at what point does the young independent students analysis maybe at least under the old regime, when did that flip over? Was it like you kind of the stay on your parents' health insurance age of 26, or like what was there an age when it would cut over where you wouldn't presumptively.
Yes, age-based. It's basically based on your actual status. Now it'll be interesting to see. So, if for FAFSA purposes you are dependent, if basically as long as you're not in the military or have children of your own. So it's very difficult for FAFSA purposes to be called independent.
Oh, really? So if you had just like gone to work when you're 18, didn't join the military, but you're not at home and you're not taking any money from home, and now you want to go back to college at 24, you're still considered a dependent?
For FAFSA purposes, yeah. If you're living with your parents, you're considered dependent.
Oh, but you have to be living with them? So if you're living on your own, then...
If you're living on your own and self-supporting, you are independent for FAFSA purposes, but the current formula assesses everything basically the same as they would for a dependent student, unless you're married with children of your own.
Ah, okay. Got it. Okay, cool.
And I think this is something that after this year might be a little bit interesting for families who, because I think a lot of families have tried not to claim their college students as dependents in order to let their college students claim the stimulus. Mm. If the parents are over the income limit. So if you're doing that for the FAFSA purposes, your student is still your dependent. Mm.
Okay. This was really interesting as always. Anne, where can folks find out more about you and your work and services?
So my blog is The College Financial Lady, and it's just thecollegefinanciallady.com. And I have tons and tons of free content on there about all these topics and a whole lot more. So that's the best place to learn more about me.
Awesome. Well, we'll look forward to sharing that link in the show notes. And as always, a pleasure talking to you. And hopefully this will be useful for our parents who have kids that are college bound in the upcoming year.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Andrew, as always.
Thanks so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. That's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed today's guest interview and got a lot of value and insights from it. If you like this episode, please hit that subscribe button to get new episodes automatically sent to you. Would love for you to not miss any episodes, because the Hack Your Wealth podcast has a mix of action-packed solo shows where I walk you through specific strategies and tactics step by step, as well as guests who share their expertise about specific areas of personal finance, and finally profile interviews of business owners who are trying to turn their side hustles into fully financially self-sustaining passive income streams. We break down exactly what they do, how they do it, and how much they're earning. So be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of that great content. Also, would love if you could help me out and take 30 seconds to go to Apple Podcasts and leave a podcast review. It helps to support this podcast, and it helps other people who are looking for topics like this find the podcast, and I really appreciate it if you could take a minute and just leave an honest review. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Hack Your Wealth podcast with Andrew Chen. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes and check out hackyourwealth.com for all our latest content.